Well, first of all, thanks very much for the invitation to come here. It was a real treat to attend this conference. I'll be talking about some what might be called trailing edge physics. It's just how to use the renormalization group. It's work done with quite a few people. I'll list them at the end of the talk. Just the first slide, I thought I would give my favorite example of how renormalization crops up even in first-year physics examples. If you just have the harmonic oscillator, it's of course characterized by three parameters: the mass of the oscillating system, the spring constant K, and equilibrium position X naught. But if you turn on a physical effect, such as a constant force field due to gravity characterized by an acceleration G, then the Lagrangian that you encounter has this extra term MgX, but that of course can be incorporated into a rescaling or a renormalization of the equilibrium position. We simply shift the equilibrium position by an amount mg over k. So the physical effect of gravity is absorbed into the value of the equilibrium position, and this might be seen as a first example of renormalization is encountered.
Not something you'd iterate. No.
This is so just incorporating a physical effect into shifting the value of a parameter that characterizes the theory. And of course, in quantum field theory, we're forced to do a renormalization in order to eliminate divergences which appear. And this results in the introduction of a scale parameter, mu squared. The size of mu squared just characterizes how much is that exactly has been absorbed into rescaling the parameters of the theory. It's much the same as the actual equilibrium position is still arbitrary because we haven't chosen a zero point for the parameter X which characterizes the position of the oscillating system. And as the first illustration of how this affects things, let's just see how this scale parameter can be used in order to analyze the connection between a bare and renormalized couplings in a minimal subtraction scheme. We'll later show how the renormalization group can be used in conjunction with computation of physical quantities. Working in in terms of a parameter epsilon, which is 2 minus the number of dimensions over 2, the bare and the renormalized couplings are related by a power series in both G and 1 over epsilon. The initial term, 1 here, is the choice that's associated with minimal subtraction. It could, in fact, be some arbitrary function of G. Now, normally, this series is characterized by summations along the horizontal, where you have, first of all, you sum the first-order poles in epsilon, then the second-order poles in epsilon, etc. But I'll show in the next slide how we could instead sum along diagonals. So please keep that in mind. Now, in the context of this relationship between the bare and the renormalized quantities, what we have to keep in mind is that the bare coupling is going to be independent of mu, because that is what occurs in the initial classical Lagrangian in n dimensions. And so changes in mu have to be compensated for by corresponding changes in the renormalized coupling G through this renormalization group equation. Beta twiddle is the n-dimensional beta function. It differs from the one that occurs in 4 dimensions through an extra factor of minus epsilon g. Now, if we sum in powers of epsilon to the minus k, in other words, we sum along the horizontal in that preceding slide, then the coefficients on this expansion are b sub k of g, with minimal subtraction b0 being equal to g, and b sub k being given by this sum L equals k up to infinity of ALKG to the power 2 L plus 1. And if we just substitute that into our start equation. Yes. If you're at 2 loop, you'll have 1 over epsilon squared, 3 loops, 1 over epsilon cubed, etc. Yeah. And the renormalization group equation, the start equation, when we substitute this series in, will be satisfied provided that we have this relationship, this iterative relationship between the functions b sub k. And if we specialize to the case k equals 0, then we recover the relationship between the first order poles and the beta function that's normally used to compute beta. The higher order or higher values of k were noted by Tooft in his original paper, but they were just treated as a consistency check to see whether calculations had been done correctly. However, there is another reorganization of this double series in which we sum over powers of g and epsilon inverse, in which we have an expansion powers of g to the 2n, with the coefficients being a function solely of g squared over epsilon, where the relationship between these expansion parameters, a and s, is as indicated in this equation. For example, S0 is the sum A00 plus A11 G squared over epsilon, A22 G squared over epsilon squared, etc. And now, if we make an expansion of the beta function in powers of G, the standard expansion in which we start at G cubed, arising from the one-loop renormalization, then we find that we have a nested series of equations which connect these functions S. At first, we encounter an equation for S0. Then we encounter an equation for S1 in terms of S0. And in general, S2 would be in terms of S1 and S0 itself. So you would solve, first of all, for S0, then for S1, etc. And defining a new parameter, W, which is 1 minus B3 times U, where U is this G squared over epsilon. And if we have this boundary condition that SK0 is equal to delta K0, then our first solution is S0 as W to the minus a half. Here's the solution for S1, and we can continue on indefinitely. I think Victor Elias and I, who looked at this, took it up to S4, if I'm not mistaken. But the interesting thing is that we can extract some general features of these functions F sub k. And in particular, if epsilon approaches 0 from the positive side, then W, being 1 minus B3 times g squared over epsilon, will actually blow up. And it turns out that each one of these coefficients, S sub k, approaches 0. It doesn't approach infinity. And as a result, we would anticipate, based on the expansion in terms of S, that the Baer coupling would approach 0 as epsilon vanishes. Well, just to review some standard lore, we would like to look at the renormalization group equation in terms of the method of characteristics. The method of characteristics is designed to analyze first-order partial differential equations which are linear in the derivatives. And a simple example would be this a by dx plus y squared a by dy equals 0. And there is an exact solution to this equation. It's easy to show that x e to the 1 over y solves this equation. And in the method of characteristics, we define two new functions, x bar and y bar, which are functions of a parameter t, which is introduced, with x dot being equal to the coefficient of dy by dx and y dot being equal to the coefficient of dy by dy evaluated at x bar and y bar, respectively, with the boundary conditions that when t equals 0, we just recover x and y. Now, it's easy to show that the total derivative of A0, a particular solution, evaluated x bar of t and y bar of t with respect to t will in fact vanish by construction, just by the way these characteristic functions have been defined. And in fact, this has two consequences. If dA evaluated x bar of t, y bar of t is equal to 0, then A0 evaluated at these points is going to be independent of t, and second of all, it's the solution to the original equations. Well, solving the characteristic functions for this particular example is quite trivial. X bar of t is just x e to the t, and y bar of t is y over 1 minus y of t. And sure enough, if we evaluated A0 of x bar of t, y bar of t at these points with these functions, then we recover the initial function. It is, in fact, independent of t. So what's the point of all this? Well, suppose instead of having A0 exactly, we only had a perturbative solution of the original equation. Suppose the e to the 1 over y was expanded only to first order and 1 over y, and we said that A0 to first order approximation is x times 1 over y, 1 plus 1 over y. then this function a1, the approximation evaluated at these characteristic functions, is going to have this value. It's not independent of t. However, there is a particular value of t for which the exact solution is reproduced. If we choose t to be 1 over y, then we recover a0 of xy at this particular value of t. So where's this all going? If we go back to our g equation for g bear, then obviously our characteristic functions mu bar and g bar are going to satisfy mu bar dot is mu bar, and g bar dot is minus epsilon g bar plus beta g bar, with the boundary conditions that mu bar and g bar become mu and g of mu at t equal to 0. Well, solving these characteristic functions is not a straightforward issue, so we'll solve them perturbatively. Following Chung and Chung, who investigated a slightly different problem, we introduced the scaling parameter lambda to just track our perturbation theory, and we expand g bar of t itself in powers of this quantity lambda. And the characteristic equations up here for mu bar and g bar can be solved, again, perturbatively. G bar naught of t is given by this expression. G bar 1 of t is given by this expression. I think I forgot to mention that the boundary conditions are that g bar of 0 when t is equal to 0 reproduces g, and g bar I of t for I greater than 1 vanishes when t is equal to 0. So with those boundary conditions, these are our functions. So you should we take these characteristic functions and plug it back into our expansion, and this is what we obtain. And we see that it still has explicit t dependence, much as in our simple-minded example, a di a by di x plus y squared di a by di y is equal to 0. However, there is a particular value of t in this case in which we recover the exact solutions s0, s1 that we had indicated on the second slide. And that particular value of t is t going to infinity. So that particular value of t, we recover the expansion for g bare in terms of these functions s0, s1, s2, etc. And once again, as epsilon goes to 0, g bare vanishes. Well, moving on to something that's a little bit more physical, we looked at a number of physical processes. In particular, let's have a look at some of the leptonic B-quark decay, in which we go to a U-quark plus two leptons. The computed cross-section is known to leading log order, and in general it contains this pre-factor, which depends on the Kobayashi-Maskawa matrix VUB, the fifth power of the running B-quark mass times some perturbative function, which depends on x. X is just the strong coupling over pi. It's just going to be scalar by pi. And L sub mu, where L is the ln of the scale parameter mu divided by the B-quark mass mb. And, of course, this should be independent of the scale parameter mu, and so we arrive at our usual renormalization group equation. The total derivative of this cross-section gamma with respect to mu now becoming a condition on this function s. The beta function and the gamma function in minimal subtraction are now going to be expanded in powers of the QCD coupling x being alpha over pi, and this function s itself is going to be expanded in powers of ln of mu over mb. The power of L being always less than or equal to the power of this coupling. And again, much as in the discussion of the relationship between the bare and the renormalized couplings, we regroup the terms in this series and expand in powers of x with the the coefficient of x to the power n being a function of the product of x with this logarithm. If we now take this form of the expansion and substitute it into our renormalization group equations, again we obtain a series of nested ordinary differential equations. We first of all encounter an equation for S0 that gives the sum of leading logs. Then S1, the sum of next to leading logs, satisfies this differential equation, which is, whose solution is contingent upon having a knowledge of what S0 is. And in fact, the solutions can now be written in this form. Again, we define 1 minus beta 0 U to be a new parameter W, and S1 has this form. The numbers A, B, and C are just messy combinations of these T00, and the first two beta function coefficients, beta 0 and beta 1, as well as gamma 0 and gamma 1. And having not much better to do at the time, we proceeded and computed the next to next to leading log and the next to next to next to leading log contributions to this function gamma. And just to show what the use of this would be, if we were to divide out that constant K, which depended on the Kobayashi-Maskawa matrix elements, the perturbative calculation has this form. But if we take this form and supplement it by the sums S0, S1, and S2, where I haven't written out S2 explicitly, but S1 and S0 are on the preceding page, then the following happens. The mu dependence of this cross-section is quite pronounced in the pure perturbative result. But if we incorporate all the extra information that the renormalization group affords us, then we find that the mu dependence essentially disappears, and we get a more precise prediction for what this cross-section would actually be. Well, we wanted to see whether this expansion in powers of S, this regrouping of the perturbative expansion for gamma, can also be reproduced by this method of characteristics. And rather than just going back and looking at this B-quark decay, well, I'll just show what happens when we look at this total cross-section for E plus E minus in the hadrons normalized by the decay rate into muons. Again, this total cross-section has this form. The function S is going to be, again, a double series in the strong coupling. Alpha strong over pi, and the log of mu squared in this place renormalized by S, the center of mass energy occurring in the annihilation. And this double series is once again reorganized into a sum in powers of x, with the coefficients being solely a function of x times this logarithm, where S in terms of these expansion parameters T is given by this form. Now, R is, of course, to be independent of mu. That, again, results in a renormalization group equations. We substitute in this power series expansion for S in terms of these functions S to acquire a knowledge of what the leading log, the next to leading log, the next to next to leading log contributions would actually be to R. But if we were to look at this from the point of view of the method of characteristics, then we define two characteristic functions, mu bar and x bar of t. Mu bar dot is going to be equal to mu bar squared, or mu bar squared dot is going to be equal to mu bar squared of t. X bar dot is going to be equal to the beta function evaluated at x bar of t. So we have two characteristic functions. Their boundary conditions, though, are going to be that these are going to be equal to the values of mu squared and the running coupling x of mu respectively. So, I'm sorry, that's a poorly drawn t there. Oh, I'm sorry, poorly drawn zero. My apologies. So the actual form of the equations for these characteristic functions are going to be exactly the same form as the equations for the running functions. It's just that the running functions now serve as a boundary condition on the characteristic functions at the point t equal to zero. And much as in the case of the relationship between the bare and the renormalized couplings, it's not possible to solve these exactly because we don't know the beta function exactly. So we insert a parameter lambda which serves as a counting parameter in a perturbative expansion. We expand x bar in powers of lambda with the boundary condition that x bar evaluated at t equals 0 vanishes except when n is equal to 0. I'm sorry to copy or cut off the delta n 0 there. A perturbative expansion of the beta function itself in powers of x leads to a series of equations for these functions x bar 1, x bar 2, etc. Nu bar can also, of course, be solved exactly. And so when we take the expansion for s, evaluated at x and l, and substitute in the values of these couplings evaluated, or rather these characteristic functions evaluated at some value of t, and collect together powers of lambda, we end up with this sort of power series. It does appear that this is not independent of t. However, we can enforce independence of t only by enforcing relationships between these expansion coefficients, t, m, n. And once we enforce these coefficients, we recover exactly the same result that we had from the renormalization group equation itself. For a particular value of t, t being equal to ln of s over mu times lambda, then at lambda equals 1, we recover precisely what we had when we had these functions s0, s1, s2, etc. Well, we looked at a number of physical processes, everything from, the two that we looked at here, B quark decays, Higgs, we looked at Higgs decays, the effective potential as derived from QCD for quark-quark interactions. And in all of these processes, incorporating these higher order effects that are accessible through the renormalization group equation gave a much diminished dependency of the physical quantity on this parameter mu squared. Well, we can also look at how the renormalization group of equation can be applied with this point of view to effective actions. For example, we looked at the effective action that results from the inclusion of instanton effects in SU2 gauge theory. Toft demonstrated that the effective action had this form. Rho is the scale parameter associated with the conformal invariance of the instanton solution. The quantity S he computed up to one loop order. In general, the form of this function S is going to be dependent upon the strong coupling evaluated at mu and the log of mu times rho. And what he succeeded at doing at one loop order was compute the two coefficients, T1 and T1 0. The integral over the scale parameter rho, he showed, actually will converge at the lower limit, rho equal to 0, due to the form of this function S. Just the one-loop calculation indicated that we didn't have any ultraviolet divergence occurring at rho equal to 0. But at rho equals infinity, for very large instantons, you're actually going to have an infrared divergent integral. And what we wanted to do is just to check to see whether inclusion of all of those logarithms which are accessible beyond what Tooft actually computed through the use of the renormalization group equation would mitigate this problem at rho equals infinity in this integral over rho. Well, the RG equation for the argument of this exponential and the effect of Lagrangian is quite straightforward. We expand the beta function in powers of the coupling. Once again, S is expanded in powers of G times a function of the product G squared times ln mu rho. S0 can be computed, and in general, Sk is in terms of Sk minus 1, Sk minus 2, etc., with the boundary condition that when W equals 1, in other words, when G is equal to 0, we recover Tk0. And it's not a big deal to compute these. But what we were able to show is that if we included the general form of the solution for S0 and S1, then we got the dominant contribution for large rho. S2, etc., did not contribute as rho goes to infinity. The net result is that ln rho goes to infinity. The rho dependence of the effective action has this form. Unfortunately, when you integrate over rho, you're still going to encounter an infrared divergence, because for a large value of rho, this expression will diverge. It's somewhat mitigated by this log raised to a negative power, but rho itself is raised to a positive power, NF being the number of flavors. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. Well, at least we have a better handle on how bad the problem is in this case, but it doesn't solve the problem, regrettably. Well, the next thing we wanted to do is look at the effective potential, and in the course of doing that, we discovered that Boris Kastening had looked at this sort of resummation of perturbation series in order to incorporate renormalization and group accessible pieces of higher order calculations. What we did initially, maybe illustrated by massless scalar quantum electrodynamics at leading log order. The Lagrangian we examined was this. We omitted any m squared phi squared part in this initial free Lagrangian. We said that the tree Lagrangian was just lambda phi to the fourth over 4 factorial. And, of course, this is the model that Coleman and Weinberg made famous, their one-loop calculation, resulted in this expression for the effective potential. The constant K is a renormalization-dependent potential, or rather, renormalization-dependent contribution to this potential. And its value is fixed by a renormalization condition. The renormalization condition that Coleman and Weinberg selected was that the fourth derivative of the potential evaluated at phi equals the scale parameter mu be equal to the coupling lambda, the physical coupling. And that, in this particular instance, serves to fix K to be minus 25 by 6. They went on to demonstrate that there is going to be a minimum of the potential at phi equal to some vacuum expectation value V. And if we were to select this scale parameter mu to be equal to V, then they demonstrated that this implies a connection between the running coupling lambda associated with phi to the fourth and the gauge coupling evaluated, raised to the power of 4, with these two running quantities evaluated at the scale parameter mu equal to V. That's associated with the fact that they've set V prime equal to 0 with phi equal to B and with mu equal to V in order to eliminate all logarithms beyond, or rather all logarithms that contribute to the effective potential. And the consequence of this is that they were able to then fix the ratio of the radiatively induced scale or mass of the scalar particle and the radiatively induced mass for the vector particle. It's going to be proportional to the square of the running gauge potential evaluated at the vacuum expectation value of the scalar particle. Here they've defined the mass of the scalar to be the second derivative of V. They've ignored all of the self-energy diagrams that give rise to a wave function renormalization for the scalar, and the mass of the vector is just going to be the gauge coupling times the vacuum expectation value. Well, we were hoping that we could do a little better than just working with this from the one loop potential. We thought, well, geez, the renormalization group equation should tell us a lot of information about logarithmic dependence or leading logarithmic dependence of higher orders in perturbation theory. The general form of the potential is going to be given by this expression, and if we apply the RG equation to what we have here, then we have this equation. We now have two couplings, the gauge coupling and the quartic scalar coupling, and gamma is the anomalous dimension of the field phi. And again, just defining x and y in terms of e squared and lambda, then the leading log contributions to S are going to have this form. The power to which the logarithm is raised is going to be less than the power to which the aggregate sum of these exponents in the couplings are going to be. I think something got cut off here. It's actually n plus k minus 1. My apologies on that. And if we were to take this equation, this RG equation, and plug in the known values of the beta functions for E and lambda, as well as the anomalous dimension, then we encounter this RG equation. Now, just the lowest order, we actually can use the RG equation to recover the known results that Coleman and Weiberg computed by an explicit evaluation of the pertinent Feynman diagrams. But now, if we regroup the terms in this sum so that we have this form of leading log approximation to S, then by the renormalization group equation, we end up with a series of nested equations for these functions S, and we end up with the following: S0, S1, S2, etc. Now remember that we actually have a double sum here. We are expanding the powers of X, which is the gauge coupling, but S itself is going to be a function of the quartic scalar coupling times the log of phi over mu. We still have an ambiguity on account of the renormalization that has occurred. We can insert an arbitrary parameter k times phi to the fourth, and what we do is just follow Coleman and Weinberg and fix k by demanding that the fourth derivative of v at phi equals mu equal to lambda. But now, again following Coleman and Weinberg and setting v prime equal to 0 when phi is equal to the vacuum expectation value of v, and then setting mu equal to v, then we obtain this rather messy equation for the relationship between the quartic scalar coupling and the gauge coupling x. It's no longer just a simple linear relationship between y and x squared. And if you have a look at the numerics involved, then you find that for each value of x, there's actually two values of y. There is a strong coupling region where x ranges all the way up to about 0.4, and then a weak coupling region. And in the weak coupling region, then we recover the Coleman-Weinberg result that y is 33 halves x squared. And the ratio of the scalar to the vector mass is now going to be this rather messy polynomial dependence on x and y. But we do recover in this weak coupling region where lambda is small and x is small that we get the Coleman-Weinberg result. Well, this is just following the RG approach to it. Yeah. No.
If you investigate the solution of the renormalization equation, you will discover that, in fact, it's not a unified free theory. Okay? So the flow of the coupling comes from the objectivity, like this will last time in a sense. And this is the strong indication that the reality is a first order phase condition. So called weak first order phase condition is very much a non-group. And so it's no longer described by a continued feature. So the physics is completely different from what they have discussed. Okay? Even other papers than papers. And I discussed with him, and he eventually agreed with my students. Exactly. They should have, I mean, he may even know about the statistical physics. But we knew it because we had to investigate. You can show that. To get a second order phase transition, you need, I think, 365 dishes of identical bosons. It's related to the number of years, it's close to the number of years, number of things in here. Okay? So if you put n copies of the scalar field, then when L is louder than some large band, then you get the entire peak point, the recovery peak point, and then it's okay. But for small values, which is any sense of money, you don't get any entire peak point. The Gaussian peak point, so you blow away. And it's, you say, when you blow away, it's not a good indication. Physically, yeah. It's a possible. Therefore, there is no quantum physical reason. Which was the strength of the form, because in three dimensions, people don't see a personal condition. So presumably it's a very weak one. Or the critical value of n changes drastically from 4 to 3, and then you have the form, which is a little bit of life.
You can then see it in simulation?
No, no, you can experiment. It looks almost like a function, but it could be just that the real region where you see that it's personal, it's not small.
Yeah, no, good heavens. Well, it became a little involved when we wanted to apply this to the Masters-Weinberg-Salam model, incorporating, first of all, the Yukawa coupling for the top quark, as well as the QCD strong coupling. And we found that, first of all, that at leading the order, the mass of the Higgs particle that seemed to come out was in the range between 220 and 231 GeV. And if you were to incorporate higher order effects that were accessible through computed values of the beta functions for the scalar and the gauge sector, then this was relatively stable. It didn't shift too much if you actually tried to incorporate as much as was known of these renormalization group functions as we were able to discover. Yes, it's pretty much on the same order of magnitude. Yeah, it's consistent with that. Yeah. Now, there's an alternative approach that Fernando Brandt, Ferrucci, and I had a look at, and we're not really sure whether what we did is right, but I thought it would be worth at least indicating what we had done and what we had obtained. What we did was say that this condition that V prime equaling zero doesn't really just fix a relationship between the couplings in the theory, but rather fixes the form of relationship between leading log and next to leading log contributions to this effective potential. And what this means concretely is that, well, if we revert back to the simple massless phi to the fourth model, and do a double expansion in powers of the coupling lambda as well as the ln of lambda phi squared over mu squared, then we obtain this series. We've used minimal subtraction in this argument, in which case we have a lambda dependence occurring in the argument of the logarithm. If you use a definition of the running coupling in terms of counter terms, then this dependency on lambda doesn't occur inside the argument of the logarithm, but that doesn't essentially affect the argument that follows. Now, what we'll do in this case is group the expansion so that we have all of the dependents of lambda in functions which are coefficients of this L to the N. So in other words, A sub N of L in principle should be the sum M equals N to infinity of TMN lambda to the N plus 1. And now, if we reapply the renormalization group equation to the expansion as indicated, then we come up with a recursion relationship between the different expansion coefficients, an of lambda. If you know a0, you get a1. If you know a1, you get a2, etc. Where beta hat and gamma hat are just rescalings of beta and gamma, respectively. Well, that equation can be more simply cast if we rescale an by this exponential factor. We define a new parameter eta, which depends on lambda, in this form, in which case that recursion relationship becomes bn plus 1 is 1 over n plus 1, first derivative of bn, which when we iterate, bn plus 1 is going to involve the n plus first derivative of b0. And so that series that occurred on the preceding slide, I'll just flash it up for a second here. This equation is the equation that's been rewritten in terms of the b's, and now this series, when rewritten in terms of the b's, can actually be summed, and we come up with a closed form solution in terms of this function a0. Once we know a0, we have the entire every term in that expansion. But now, if we were to apply this condition that says that dv by d phi is equal to 0 at phi equals v, and choose mu so that these logs disappear, then we come up with a simple relationship between a1 and a0. a1 is minus 2 a0. This is the equation that Coleman and Weinberg had used at one loop order in order to fix the relationship between E and lambda in minimal in scalar electrodynamics. But we'll just treat this as a relationship between the functions a0 and the function a1. So now we have two conditions on a0 and a1, and together they lead to a fairly simple differential equation for a0. A0 is the first order, satisfies this first order differential equation. It can be solved in terms of the beta function. But the remarkable thing is, and this really surprised us, is that if we take this function a0 and substitute back into the solution that we had obtained on the preceding slide, if we actually know what a0 is, then we have all of the dependence on phi canceling, and v is completely flat. And if you take this equation and substitute back into the RG equation, it actually satisfies the RG equation. So it's a solution. We were wondering what happened in massless scalar quantum electrodynamics. Exactly the same thing happens. All of the phi dependence cancels out in the massless theory. Another thing we did was consider the effective action in supersymmetric Yang-Mills models. In supersymmetric Yang-Mills models, we can make use of some standard results. First of all, if phi is equal to F squared, where F is a background Yang-Mills field strength in these massless, or rather in these supersymmetric Yang-Mills models, then the trace of the stress tensor has been shown. I guess it was Adler and collaborators showed that it was proportional to the beta function, and that the stress tensor itself, its expectation value, can be expressed as a functional equation of the effective action L. Well, the solution to these two equations can be written in this form, where the function g bar of Tg is defined by these two equations. T itself is a function of the renormalized, or rather, of the renormalized coupling g. Phi is F squared, and mu is the scale parameter that's occurring anytime you are confronting with a renormalization. And T is used to define g bar in this fashion here. Well, the effective action satisfies this RG equation, and the anomalous dimensions of the vector field gamma is actually related to the beta function, because the product of the renormalized coupling and the renormalized field strength has to be renormalized in order to ensure that we have gauge invariance in the background field. And actually, this relationship between L and the beta function was used by Gerald Dunn, Harold Geiss, and Christian Schubert to actually take a computed value for the effective action in quantum electrodynamics in the case where the background field was self-dual in order to obtain the two-loop beta function. But Victor Leiss and I decided we could look at turning this around and using a situation in supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory where the beta function is known to actually compute what the effective action would be. And in n equals 1 SU3 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, this is the form of the beta function. Now, what we start with is the Lambert W function. It's the inverse of this simple relationship between X and W. And if we define Y bar and Y in this form, where Y bar is related to G bar and Y is related to G by this rescaling of minus 4 pi squared over 6, then the resulting expression for the effective action as a function of phi squared is given by this equation here. And if we want to find out what value of phi would maximize L, then we can use this simple expression for the derivative of W in terms of W at itself, evaluated at eta. We find that L prime is equal to zero at this expectation value of phi. And this actually provides a maximum value of L. If you look at the second derivative, then you find that L double prime evaluated at this point has a negative value. And perhaps more simply, in n equals 2 rather than n equals 1 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory for the SU3 case, the beta function is saturated at one loop order. If we repeat this analysis, then here's the form of the effective Lagrangian, and it too has a maximum, and the maximum value of F squared is given by this expression here. So I guess there's a number of other things that we apply these ideas associated with the renormalization group to. We looked at... I'm sorry? Well, I'm not 100% sure. But with the Seiberg-Witten case, they looked at a fully supersymmetric background. And this is not supersymmetric. We've chosen an explicit background field consisting solely of a field strength, which was non-zero. And that is intrinsically not supersymmetric. We don't have any expectation values for the fields phi. So we're not able to trace the relationship between the Seiberg-Witten solution and this one. No. No, we don't seem to get any instanton contributions at all. So, which, of course, is key to their to their whole result. So. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right, yeah. It just is a solution of the RG equation. Yeah, these are constant fields, though. So the correlators are trivial in that case because all of the momentum. Just much like in the Heisenberg-Euler-Lagrangian, except this incorporates all of the terms on the beta function rather than just the one-loop beta function, which would be associated with one-loop Euler-Heisenberg Schwinger effective Lagrangian. Well, I'd just like to list a number of people that have worked on various aspects of this. And